This is an Enterprise Time Security podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Chris Weisopel, founder and CTO of Vericode.
Hi, Ian. It's great to be here. I founded Vericode in 2006. I've been with the company the whole 14 years. Before that, and some of the reasons I founded Vericode was I was a security consultant that focused on application security. I did things like code reviews, manual pen testing for banks, e-commerce places, also software vendors. I came to the conclusion that there weren't enough security people that understood application security to keep up with all the developers. And that was back in 2006. We know how the world of application security has exploded. But I started doing this even before that as a hacker. I was part of a group called Loft Heavy Industries. We had what we called a hacker think tank, and we were early vulnerability researchers. We came up with techniques for finding vulnerabilities in software very manually. I had been doing manual detection of vulnerabilities for many, many years through a variety of code review, pen testing, fuzzing, using all these different techniques. By the time 2006 came around, me and my co-founder, Christian Ryu, said, this has got to be a highly automated thing. Code reviews take too long. No one wants to do them. It's too expensive. Same thing with manual pen tests. If you have to do a manual pen test, fine. But most of the time, you don't. That's where we came up with the idea of Vericode. We really came out of our experience as vulnerability researchers, then later application security consultants. So we both knew the hardcore technological part of the problem, but as consultants, we also understood how businesses wanted to engage and what businesses' needs were about securing software. It's very different to be an outsider finding a vulnerability than someone who's doing it for hire for a business. And so I feel like I had some good formative experiences. And so in 2006, I took the leap and said, let's start a company.
You've recently released your state of software report. You're talking about some of the findings at the show. But one of the big challenges we face is the speed with which the amount of software that we face grows. It's growing faster than the birth rate on this planet. Not quite as fast as IoT, but actually, there are parts of what we're seeing which are pretty comparable. It's taking us into areas that we never thought we'd see software. The connected car, aeroplanes that might end up flying themselves with no pilots. Yet we still struggle to secure the most simple sort of software, basic enterprise software. How do we become a better industry?
I'm talking about our report, which is a sort of a small slice. I wish it was a bigger slice because we're talking about Vericode customers, but it's a slice of 2,500 customers, tens of thousands of applications, 8 million findings. And what can we learn from that? I think the number one thing we learn is all software is insecure. I think we find that over 70% of software has vulnerabilities. So even when people are trying hard, they're a customer of ours, they're trying to do this, they're still releasing software with vulnerabilities in it. It's a big problem because, as you say, software is proliferating into every single corner and crevice of the world. Every single business is using software to be more efficient. It's in third world countries where people are selling things off the back of a donkey pulled cart, but they're using their mobile phone for transactions, they're calendaring, contacting customers, they're using apps because the mobile phone and infrastructure allows them to do that. So even in the most backwards places, applications are making businesses run more efficiently and more effectively and better, and that's why we see them explode. The other aspect of it is just not the quantity, but the churn, the change. You don't put an application out there now and then a year later update it with what you learned over the year, what your customers asked you for, what you saw your competitors doing. You're doing that almost on a daily basis today, where Snapchat will come out with a cool new feature and Instagram will have that feature a week later because, hey, that's a great idea. Our users want that too. And so software becomes a competitive driver for the business. The challenge for us security people is, there's a huge number of applications. They're changing rapidly. Everything's got to go fast because if you copy the Snapchat feature 6 months later, that's not as competitive as doing it a week later. You lose users. Oh, I'm going to go try Snapchat. It's got this cool new thing. My friend showed me. It's quantity, it's churn, it's speed. And if you think about it, that's a challenge for security people. It's really a challenge if you think about us doing it the old way. And the old way was you had a security team, which were the assessors. They were the cops. They were the traffic guards. They were the guy raising the gate after he checks your ID. If you think about it in the sense of security was done in a manual way, it was a control that a person did an activity and said whether something was thumbs up or thumbs down. That idea of having people in the loop, and gates that stop something until something changes doesn't work anymore. That's not how software is developed. Software is developed in a continuous model now. I've heard of companies where on day one, they incent their first-time coders to make a code change that gets pushed into production on their first day of work. Think of that model, and you say, we need to completely change the way we do security around software that fits into that new model. It's got to be continuous. It's got to be fast. We can't eliminate people, but we have to get people out of the loop wherever we can.
We like as an industry to blame the developers or blame the end users or blame the customers. But actually, our own software isn't always as good as it should be. How does the software industry, the software security industry, change its approach to what is secure or insecure? Should it release software with levels of risk, e.g., we know that this is absolutely secure, no risks. This down here is not so secure, so you use it as is. Because if we're going to change people's understanding of what risk means when they start to use software, somebody has to lead. Is the security industry the right leader?
I don't have a problem with software that some has gone through intensive processes that maybe take more time, maybe take more expertise, maybe take more technology, maybe it's more expensive versus software that's released with almost nothing. I don't have a problem with that. The problem I have is there's no transparency to tell the difference between the two. Everyone wants to say their software is secure. But it's rare that people are transparent about the process that went into securing the software. I am a big advocate for transparency in what security processes you actually have as an organization that went into building the software. This is one of the reasons we came up with the Veracode Verified program, because we wanted our customers, say a small software vendor who has to show that they're making secure software to deliver to their enterprise customer, we want them to be able to describe that they did do the secure thing and have a third party validate it. And we think having our Veracode Verified program, which basically says, take the things that Veracode knows a software vendor is doing, like we know they're scanning their code, we know what their policy is, we know what residual risk they're leaving, we know how often they're scanning, so we can tell if it's probably continuously integrated, because no one manually is going to be scanning their code multiple times a day. We know if their developers are trained. We know if they're looking at the open source that comes in. So since we know all these things, we can document it for our customers, and we can allow our customers to be transparent. Of course, they're only going to be transparent when they meet all these expectations. But what we've done is we've allowed vendors to communicate their security posture in them building the code and use that as a competitive advantage. That can help drive the transparency, because if they have a competitor that is unable to communicate what they did or is communicating it in a vague way, like, oh yeah, we're secure, we do application security testing, versus someone who has, we don't let vulnerabilities over this risk score into our software. We're testing continuously. Our developers are trained. And guess what? Don't take our word for it. Veracode can validate that we're doing this stuff. That helps the transparency, because it becomes a competitive advantage for that one vendor over the other one. They're going to be smoother through a sales cycle once they get to the compliance team that's going to say, hey, we can only buy software that is developed at this level. I'm for ways of describing and documenting the contents of the process that went into building the software and the contents itself with a bill of materials, like what open source are you using. That helps transparency. So I think transparency is what we need so that we don't get sort of a lemon market, which you get with cars. If there was no rating system, if manufacturers could kind of sneak a bad car and kind of get away with it, transparency makes it so that you can't get away with making bad software and selling it as good software.
I'm so glad you opened that door to cars there, because one of my bugbears over the last few years has been, if I buy a consumer product, there's a whole wealth of consumer law behind that. If my fridge catches fire because it's a manufacturing error, I'm not responsible. The manufacturer is responsible. If I look at any end user license agreement in this industry, it basically says, screw you. You use this at risk. We're never responsible for our product. Yet we're reaching that point now where every single consumer product contains huge amounts of software. Connected cars will be that ultimate point. How do we match existing consumer law and expectation with the way the software industry behaves?
That is a very challenging problem, because if you think about it, the way the software industry has been able to flourish, even the way the open source industry has been able to flourish, is because of the lack of liability. It would be a big fundamental change, and I don't know if that would ever fly. But that said, you bring up the point of the consumer law, and there's regulations, and there's liability around certain things, and the vendor can't disclaim liability for that. So, for instance, if a connected toy causes a child to choke on a part, there's liability for that. If that connected toy is used to spy on the child and harass the child, or an attacker can harass the child, or the company itself can spy on the child, there's really no consumer protection around that. I've asked in the U.S., there's a consumer protection agency, and whenever it comes to harms caused by information, which we know are real, people get their Twitter account taken over and they get harassed online and their reputation is put at risk. Those are real harms that there's no recourse to. Maybe in a court of law, if you can find the person that did it, but the intermediaries that allowed it to happen aren't liable. So we have to have some regulations around when there are these information failures so that there are specific things with specific penalties when they go wrong. I think part of the reason companies like the no liability is because the liability is kind of endless. Think of a hedge fund calculating their next $1 billion purchase of a stock, and there's an error as a bug in the spreadsheet that computes the error. My first job was working for Lotus 1-2-3, where we made spreadsheets, and this was the big fear. There was like, we won't be able to spread spreadsheets because people are doing financial decision-making based on it. And what if we get it off by a factor of 10? There's a mistake, and they make a $1 billion purchase instead of the $100 million purchase. We can't be liable for $900 million. We'd never be able to sell the software. So I understand where unlimited liability might be a problem, but why couldn't we have some regulations that for each privacy violation, there's a penalty? And maybe it doesn't actually even go to the end user. It just becomes a penalty to the company that created the software.
But we are on that privacy breach starting to see those penalties. We have GDPR in the UK. We have the Californian law that's come into force. We've got very strict laws in Singapore, Australia, even China, a country that's often torn apart for what is seen as being a lack of control, actually has a very interesting set of privacy laws in place. But much of the damage to a company is perceived to come from reputational damage. Well, as Target can attest, yeah, we took a short hit. 18 months later, share price was back where it was and it's moved on upwards ever since. There is no real recourse or damage, but there is at least an effort to get there. When you talk to customers about the software they're creating and the software they're building themselves and using in their business, how many of them actually think about the potential risk that brings on board?
Just to go back to the privacy regulations, they're very, very tightly constrained within specific use cases. It's essentially you are a custodian that is collecting PII, so there's a very certain kind of data that you are collecting. You're not a good custodian of that data. If you don't protect it well enough, given the known risks of the internet, then you get fined. We have seen big fines for certain kinds of companies, but it's actually very constrained. If we go back to the example of your refrigerator that could catch on fire, but what if the refrigerator has a Wi-Fi interface and you've been sold that as a really interesting way of maybe being able to check what food's in your refrigerator from your mobile device when you're out shopping? You can say, how many quarts of milk do I have in it? It has a camera in it or something. Well, what if your privacy is violated because there's a vulnerability in the refrigerator? What if someone's able to take over your refrigerator and now they get on your local network and now they can turn on listening devices in your house? They can look at all your photos in your photo collection. They can look at all kinds of other data. That's outside of that small box of a custodian of PII, and there's no recourse there. That's where the change has to happen in order for people to be more secure generally.
I spoke with a white goods manufacturer a number of years ago, and their view was quite simply, we understand mechanicals. We don't understand the internet. We are not a software company. We therefore cannot be liable for whatever happens with this fridge or a washing machine or a dishwasher or anything else. And that's sort of been skirted around and comes back to what you're saying, if you get that breach. But that then does escalate into enterprises when they start to use software. Enterprises buy in software, but they never really check or validate that software, particularly if it comes from a large software vendor. They make an assumption of what it's supposed to be. But they write an awful lot of software. In many cases, they customize that software. And for the large vendor, that gives them a perfect out. Well, it's not as we delivered. You, the customer, made those changes, caused the problem. Do companies today start to understand the risk of some of what they do and factor that in at a board level? Or is there just this rush to get more software out to give us a competitive edge?
The more forward-thinking companies I've interacted with, a few boards, do take software risk into account. They do treat it as a business risk because it's something that they can control. There are risks that businesses can't control. They can't really control a recession. They can't control hurricanes. They can kind of plan for them. But software risk is largely under their control. What boards ask the senior leadership of the team is to be able to manage the risk in the software and come up with what they think is the appropriate risk tolerance for the organization and manage it. We have customers that are all over the spectrum. We have customers that are like aerospace customers. They can tolerate very little risk. And it isn't just if you're writing the software to fly a plane or is going to run a satellite or a rocket. It's anywhere in their business because the reputational risk of this thing crashed or this thing leaked data will translate to the other parts of the business and people will be more suspect and the brand will be tarnished, even if it isn't that. We also have media companies as customers, and media companies are very tolerant around risk. What's the big problem? A website got defaced, a little customer leakage. It's different, customer data leakage. You know, a training company or an educational company, much higher risk tolerance. So there's no one size fits all. It's really boards want to know that you're managing risk appropriately across the business. And now they are educated that the risks stemming from the software they're building or purchasing or incorporating in open source needs to be managed. That's one of the things we at Veracode help them do with bubbling up these analytics and reports that are at the highest level that the board can understand.
I like the fact you've talked about risk. One of the things I hear all too often is people go in to talk to a board and they talk about zero-day events. They talk about ransomware. They talk about malware. They talk about APTs. And quite frankly, most boards sit there, completely zone out, and go to their happy place. Slowly, we're starting to see people come in and talk about risk. That's the word that the board knows. It's the word the board understands. When you look at the results and the analytics that you've managed to gather from your customers, how much of that risk is truly understood, and how do you expose that in your analytics so that they understand that this is risk and not just a set of random numbers?
What the board wants to see is they want to see that you've determined the appropriate risk level. You've put policies in place to say whether something is compliant or non-compliant at that risk level, and that you're managing, you're collecting the right data. You know where you have the inappropriate level of risk. For example, with application security, you can easily explain to a board that we have different testing techniques to test what vulnerabilities and hence what risks are in an application. We set a policy that is commensurate with the risk tolerance of the organization and then for that specific application. And then what we can report to you is how many of the applications that we care about are either in policy or out of policy. And they can say, I want you to put a program in place that you can show me 99% compliance by end of next quarter. That's the level that boards can understand managing risk. They don't know what a SQL injection is. They don't know what software composition analysis is. But they know that you know what those things are. And they know you've put a policy in place that can measure those things and translate it to compliant or non-compliant. And you can report and you can show your improvement over time to be getting to 100% compliance.
Are you seeing a maturity curve either by size of company, by industry, or by experience of the board, something which is often overlooked here? But are you seeing a maturity curve that's allowing you to plot very quickly where customers are and what actions they need to take to move themselves up that curve?
You raise an interesting topic is maturity of the board as it comes to security. I found that boards are ignorant of security until they have a breach or a near peer has a breach. I was talking to the CISO of a North American airline, and the day before, British Airways had a breach. He said, I had a board member call me up this morning who saw the news in the Wall Street Journal and said, what are we doing to make sure that this doesn't happen to us? There's breach news in all the time, but that board member saw it was a competitor of theirs, a peer of theirs. That's what resonated and made them think about it. I find that it's when there's a breach at the organization, we all know the target board members are very aware of what's going on. When there's a breach at the organization or a peer, that's when boards recognize that they should be asking questions. They need to get answers and they need to be satisfied with those answers. That's how I see boards maturing. As far as industries, we slice our data by industry. So I can tell you financial services versus healthcare versus education, media, manufacturing, government, and show what the, maybe not maturity, but at least what risk they're tolerating. Does that make any sense? When I look at education, they're tolerating a lot of risk. I mean, maybe that makes some sense. You know, they have a lot of student data. But on the other hand, they're not getting paid a lot. Maybe it's not as critical as planes falling out of the sky. But then I look at healthcare, and I look at the healthcare data, and they're also low. And that is something where risk shouldn't be tolerated, because the data is much more sensitive, and potentially it's a life or death situation in certain cases. I have to infer maturity, but it's easy for us to tell how much risk is being tolerated by industry.
I find the healthcare example interesting because this is a country where everything's a private healthcare system. It's not state like in the UK where I live. And in a state system, the issue is there's no money, there's no time. We've had grand projects all sponsored by government and they all fail. Whereas here, it's insurance companies, it's facilities that are fighting for every last penny that they can extract out of this from both the patient and the insurance companies. So you would think that their level of maturity and responsibility and reactiveness would be quite high.
You would think so because there are fines and that hits the bottom line, especially when margins are slim. It's competitive, so a customer can go to a different service provider, healthcare provider. You would think it would be better. I don't know if I could compare the U.S. to other countries. I don't know if I have that data, but it's interesting that there should be a competitive element to it, being it's a for-profit business. But I don't see the competitiveness getting to healthcare. I mean, maybe it's because everything is so opaque as far as what you're actually getting, what actually you're paying. It's very different than a lot of other industries. It's certainly different than the automotive industry where you get all these third-party reviewers and everything is quantized.
There's a whole podcast in that around healthcare. Chris, thank you for talking to me today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.